Now, we'll get started. The Great Dispersion. Now, this is an interesting topic to me because I have found so many wonderful bits of information as I was studying this. We looked at the scripture today, and it says they journeyed east. Actually, last week, I think you covered this. They journeyed east to the land of Shinar and settled there. Well, Shinar is the same thing as the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, and it's the closest fertile area to the mountains of Ararat. The most ancient people leaving written historical records are the people who lived in that area, the Sumerians, just as expected, followed by those who lived in the Nile Valley of Egypt and other Near Eastern civilizations, just as expected. And this area is the geographical center of the Earth's land surface. Do you think that's a coincidence? I don't. I think it was planned. They said, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they built a city and a tower so they could make a name for themselves. Interestingly enough, there's no local stone in that area. And they did have to make their own rock. Rock was made by burning local clay at very high temperatures. And then the rock was used for building. On Mondays, in the Dallas Morning News, there's a section in the business section called the Discoveries section. And I get all kinds of information from that section. Most of the time it's science, but sometimes it's history and archaeology. And I have picked up a lot of articles over the last 4 or 5 years that completely give credence to what we're studying in Scripture. And this is one of them. There are written records that describe Babylon's being built by this process of burning rock, making their own rock. And they actually have samples that they've studied. The archaeologists said that it required potters and metallurgists to be working together. And this surprised them that the people would be working together at this time. Now, does it surprise you? No, it doesn't. In fact, it fits right in with our story. Then it said that they used tar for mortar. Well, another article that I found said that those same ancient people used a sticky coal-based tar as glue on wood and stone. This was found in the same area. So it completely surprises them. It says this surprised archaeologists. Doesn't surprise us. The scripture said it did, that they used it. Okay, they built a city and a tower. The usual picture that you see is that of a ziggurat, the step-like tower. There is a building over in that area of Babylon that they think might be the, you know, original Tower of Babylon. I mean, it doesn't have a title, you know, that says this is the Tower of Babylon. But they think it is. And it's a ziggurat. These acted as artificial mountains that became the center of worship in the city. A miniature temple was at the very top of the tower. And your kids are building a Tower of Babel today as their artwork. I think it's going to be really cute. Then the Lord said, behold, there are one people, and all have the same language. And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. First of all, erase the picture of these savage, ignorant, backwards people, as usually depicted in books or movies. I mean, their forefathers are the ones that built cities, herded livestock, built musical instruments, forged metals out of bronze and iron, and built the unsinkable ark. So they were not savages. They were intelligent men. But they had one problem, and that was they were foolish. Foolish men. Not savages, but foolish men. The scripture says, let us confuse their language. This is God talking. That they may not understand one another's speech. There the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the whole earth. And these are the families of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, that by their nations, and out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. The builder's sin was immense pride, which led to open rebellion against God, declaring independence of him. What did they not want to do? They did not want to be scattered over the face of the earth, and they wanted a name for themselves to be made. A common language enabled that rebellion. And as God usually does, he deals with us where we are and what our needs are and what's best for us. And so his decision was that he would confuse the languages and separate them that way. In Acts 17, this is one of my very favorite passages, and I use it a lot because it says so much. From one man he made every nation that they should inhabit the whole earth. He determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. And this leads us to a question. Did the separation of people into language groups at the Tower of Babel and their subsequent migration to all parts of the earth really happen? Well, if it really happened, what would you expect to find? Evidence through archaeology, written records, language studies that all people have migrated from that area in the past. You'd also expect to find similarities of cultures between civilizations that were thousands of miles apart. This is what you would expect to find. And that they would have histories that contain traces of the creation, the fall, and the flood. Now, since the 1960s, the idea of cultural diffusion, and that cultural diffusion is that one culture borrowed some aspects from another culture in developing its own civilization. That has been nixed. That is an idea that's politically incorrect, that a culture could not have been totally independent, producing its own culture alone. However, the evidence shows otherwise. And I read an article recently where an archaeologist was saying this is totally stupid to stick to this idea. But it all goes along with that nationalism, that ethnicity, that trying to avoid any kind of looking down on people, you know, by saying that they had to borrow something from another culture. What do we find? And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. All people have migrated from Shinar. Earth could have been filled in a few centuries. Remember, I talked to you about those land bridges that connected the continents. There were a number of land bridges, so there was no problem with people getting to the islands, getting to Australia, getting to England, getting to America from Asia. How'd they travel? Well, by wagon, of course, right? I read an article just this past couple of weeks that they found wagon wheels in Western Asia, and they talked about having wagons in Asia Minor. And they think that all wagons originated in that area of the Middle East, the Near East. They could have traveled by wagons. I'm not saying they did. But they could have traveled by wagons. But there was another Dallas Morning News article that said early humans were able to build watercraft. Surprise them. Does that surprise you that they could build a boat? You know, even in some of the scriptures that you had to read today for your passage, it talked about a certain group of people that were seafarers. Well, in order to be a seafarer, you have to build a boat. Now, they built a boat out of reeds. I don't know if I'd get on that boat. It's just not surprising to us that they could build boats. Most civilizations appeared about the same time. You find ziggurats, or a type of pyramid-type shaped building, or a mound of dirt in the shape of a pyramid, in civilizations all over the earth, and in fact, nearly every ancient civilization, just as expected. Recorded history is only in the past several thousand years. Actual recorded written history. Before that is pure speculation. Man, of course, is the only reliable recorder of history. If you take written documents that are not, let's say, radiocarbon or tree ring based, but are actual written documents, that's the only real reliable recorder. And in the book of Job, he refers to three methods of writing that were already common in those days. We already know about the writing on clay tablets, but they also talked about writing on scrolls or books, inscribing with an iron stylus on lead, and engraving in rock slabs. So writing in the time of Job, which was about 2000 BC, was all these different styles. They were recording what their history at the time. And truly verified archaeological datings, that is based upon written records, not radiocarbon dates or tree rings, do not predate the time period that we consider was likely for the flood, and that is from about 3,000 to 2,500 BC, somewhere around that time period. And this is really strange if men have been living around the earth for thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. But it's just as expected if the Bible is true. The Table of Nations, what you've studied in Genesis chapter 10, which most everybody goes, yawns at, and usually skip if you're reading through the Bible. Why read that chapter? Why did we make you read that chapter? We made it because God put it in there, and he put it in there for a reason. Otherwise, he wouldn't have wasted his time on it. He put it in there so you could see that these were real people, and that he did scatter these people out to form the nations of the earth. And I had you read the other passages, which they were not easy to understand, trying to figure out what they were talking about, to show that 2,000 years later, these were still referred to as real people, nations that came from the people that are listed in Genesis chapter 10. It has relevance. Now, you may never study it again, and that's okay. And you can skip it from now on, but you know something about it that other people don't. The hypothesis is, after confusing the languages, you had the groups that separated out, and they as their families grew larger, they separated out, growing, you know, more and more families developed, more and more languages developed until the earth was populated. And of course, each family group would have had to learn to survive in the land in which it migrated. Many of these early nations, by the way, kept an accurate record of their beginnings down the centuries, writing down the names of their founding patriarchs and recording this for us, providing us with a surprising link with the post-flood era and the rest of recorded history. And you probably studied ancient history before, but this is the rest of the story. Okay, Japheth, I know some of your Bibles said he was the younger brother of Shem. Some of them said he's the oldest of Shem. It really doesn't matter. But mine says he's the oldest. He had six sons that went north to Western Asia and Europe, and one whose families went east to Persia and India. These can be traced to be the ancestors of the Indo-European language groups of people that are spoken mostly in Europe, India, Pakistan, and parts of Western Asia. Now, interestingly, these Indo-European families, that they have a common, it's not a common language, but a common class of languages. There's something common about all these languages. Gomer, who is the oldest son of Japheth, his sons formed the Celtic and Germanic language families, which included Irish, Welsh, Italic, German, English, and all those others mentioned. Japheth's families, Japheth was another son of Japheth, formed the Greek language group, Medai or Medes, language were spoken in Iran and India. But some of Shem's and Ham's kin also spoke some Indo-European languages, so it wasn't strictly by bloodlines there. Now, Japheth's clan went north and northwest. Gomer's name, the name Gomer, is preserved in two places, the Cimmeria, which is the Crimea, north of the Black Sea, and Germany. They think that the name Germany comes from Gomer's name. Now, Gomer had a son named Ashkenaz. And Ashkenaz first settled in Armenia, and his tribe was called, through a bunch of translations from one language to another, became known as the Skuzas, and the Greeks called them the Scythians, Scythians or Scythians, I don't know if it's a silent C or not. Ashkenaz is also identified with Germany. In fact, the Jews always traditionally identified Ashkenaz with the German people, and German Jews to this day are called Ashkenazi. You may notice it now. There may be an article in the paper over the next few weeks that refer to the Ashkenazi, and you know who they are. Also, Ashkenaz and Gomer's families went to Denmark, which is the source of the Anglo-Saxons, who later became part of England, and the Northern Islands. The western shores of the continent, the Gauls, and then the Irish Celts all traced their ancestry through Gomer. And then Magog, Meshach, and Tubal, some other Japheth's kids, formed the nations around the Caspian and Black Seas that went all the way to Russia. Now, what's the evidence? Well, recorded ancestries that predate Christianity or Jewish influence in an area that were there before they ever met any Christian missionaries or had any Jews in their area, these recorded ancestries of the early Britons, the Irish Celts, the Anglo-Saxons, the Danes, and the Norwegians all include their descent from Noah through Japheth. They and specifically mention him. This one particular book called After the Flood is one man's 25-year study of all of the ancient documents that were recorded by those particular peoples. And he's done textual criticism, literary criticism, historical criticism, forgery criticism, and has determined that they were valid documents. And he's written about it in these books. If this is something that just really turns you crank, this is a good book. If you really like languages and, you know, ancient history, if you're from that area and you want to do some more study, it's a good book. Now, one of the things that's interesting, the Saxons considered Japheth, whom they called Sheaf, that's just the translation through the language, they called him Sheaf, the son of Noah, in their recorded histories. And they considered Japheth to be the founder of the European nations and traced their own ancestry through Gomer. The Irish Celts have king lists that go back to Noah through Japheth by way of Gomer and Magog. Both of their families had mixed in the area of Armenia, which the Greeks call them the Scythians. And the earliest Irish chronicles insisted the people were of Scythian stock. and the associated name Scott is a Greek and Saxon conversion from Scythian. And he goes through the linguistic progression there. If you're Scottish, you know, this might be of interest to you. The area of Galatia, which is Paul's letter to the Galatians, the people that lived in that area were related to the Gauls of France and the Celts of Ireland. They were all the same people group. They spoke a similar language. This is all confirmed by archaeology. The early Britons recorded in 58 surviving manuscripts. Now that's a lot, 58 surviving manuscripts, that their ancestors were from Asia Minor and that they traveled by sea, stopping at various countries along the way before reaching the shores of England. It goes through various details, you know, which countries they stopped in and who they saw and that in this book if you're interested. Now, what's some evidence of this? This is really interesting. The Miatsu people of China, this is in a northwestern province of China, so it would be the very western part of China, claim their descent from Japheth through Gomer, and they kept it recorded as recited couplets that have gone back from ancient times, and all public occasions they recite these couplets. And it was recited word for word through the years. When the first missionaries got there, they were astounded that these people had all this information from creation all the way down to the present, that they in the form of these couplets. And it included all the names of Noah's sons, and including his wife's name, Noah's wife, her name, and a graphic account of Babel and the confusion of tongues resulting in nations spreading out, encircling the globe. They claim, according to their history, that 11 of their tribes settled in that area in the fifth generation from Gomer. So this would have been just a couple of generations after the Tower of Babel. And that 5 of them remained in that area, but 6 of them later intermarried with the invading Chinese who forced the Miatsu out of their land. Now, interestingly, there's a Dallas Morning News article recently that said people once living in northwestern China from 2000 to 400 BC wrote in a Celtic Germanic language, which is the Gomer's descendants were the formed that Celtic Germanic language group, unlike any other in that part of the world. They found 100 mummies in an area of 500 square miles, all of babies to adults, old people, showing that it was a civilization that lived there, that it wasn't just travelers passing through. And they had European features, long noses and skulls, blonde or brown hair, thin lips, and deep-set eyes. Some look Irish, and others look Nordic. They were forced out of their land. The answers in Genesis, these were Japheth's kin. It doesn't surprise us that they're there. It certainly surprised these archaeologists, and they're trying to figure out how they got there. More of Japheth's descendants, Mede's grandkids went on to India. And interestingly, Japheth, his name is preserved as Prajapati, Father Japheth, the reputed ancestor of the Aryans, worshipped as Lord of creation for those descended from him. And they have found that the Indus civilization that existed in Pakistan and western India during that early time period was very organized, largely unmilitary. In fact, it was very much like the Sumerian civilization. They built efficient cities, not elaborate ones, out of baked bricks. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. Not only that, they practiced a millet cultivation that was similar to that done in Africa. Well, if you had a common source, the people were all there at Babel, they would have taken this knowledge with them. It's not surprising that they do something similar to what the people in Africa do. I have more about Japheth than anybody else. So, Javan, who was another one of Japheth's sons, his group went west to Turkey and then on to Greece and Rhodes and Cyprus and eventually all the way to Spain and northwest Africa. Now, interestingly enough, one of Javan's sons was Tarshish. Have you heard that name before? Tarshish. It's a city in Spain. And once the Mediterranean Sea was called the Sea of Tarshish. Javan, in the translation of his name, became Ionia, which became known as the Greeks. It's identified with the Greeks. And his son, Elisha, something like that, is preserved in the name Hellas, which came to be applied to Greece as a whole, like the Hellenistic culture, Hellenism, and so forth. Probably is the source of the Greek paradise, the Elysian fields. Japheth, the name is preserved in Greek literature as Iapetos, the son of heaven and earth, father of many nations, especially the Greeks. And the ancient Romans kept his name as Iupater, father Jove, which became Jupiter. and that little bottom note was just a comment that I found about the kids that settled in Thrace. They were ruddy, blue-eyed, and always tipsy. How would you like that to be your historical epitaph? As far as Shem, we studied that today, and there's really not much information that I have for you about them, except that Asher may be the first man to be deified and worshipped by his descendants. And that's kind of sad, you know, being one of Shem's descendants. And Arphaxad, one of Shem's kids also, is known as the father of the Chaldeans. Where else do we find about the Chaldeans in the Bible? The Babylonians were Chaldeans. They're the ones who took Jerusalem and took all the Israelites captive and brought them to Babylon. And Daniel had to study the way of the Chaldeans. And then the three kings, the wise men that came to see Jesus, were all Chaldeans. You had that in your lesson today. As far as Ham, the only thing interesting that I found of Ham is that he had two sons named Heth and Sin. And Heth is probably the ancestor of the Hittites. It says, after it mentions those names, it says, afterward, the families of the Canaanites were spread abroad. And it's possible that his two sons are the most likely ancestors of the Oriental peoples. And the connections there, the similarities between the Hittites and the Mongolians in the art of smelting and casting iron, the breeding and training of horses. The Native Americans have their ancestry in the Mongolian peoples. There's four genetic markers in the Native Americans that are identical to the Mongolians and the Siberian people. And the biblical Hittites were known to the Sumerians as Kittai and to the Assyrians as Kati, which may be the origin of Cathay, which is one of the cities over there. And as far as S-I-N, I'm going to say Sin. Biblical and secular references are to a people in the Far East that are named the Sinim or the Sinai. And the Assyrians knew them as the Sianu. China and Chinese people have always been identified by the prefix Sino, like the Sino-Japanese War, whatever. You don't understand it, but if you look at it from this viewpoint, maybe there's a reason behind it. The Dallas Morning News, I had an article that the genetic makeup of the Chinese people correlates with the people in Africa, which if they were Ham's descendants, they would. And that scientists found a distinct genetic difference between people living in northern China from those living in southern China, like the Mongolians as opposed to those from Sin's ancestry. And that would be just as expected as well. I'm just giving you possibilities. I'm not saying that we're definitely there. Interestingly, 3,000 years ago in the Western Hemisphere, the Olmec culture in Mexico and Central America, there's 100 ancient Chinese symbols that are embedded in the motifs decorating Olmec art. And it just so happens that that particular civilization developed about the same time as the fall of the Chinese Shang Dynasty. And it was recorded that during that time, refugees fled across the Eastern Sea. And there are a lot of common elements involved. And I talked to you last week about, or a couple of weeks ago, about land bridges, you know, showing how they would have gone down. It's interesting that at some of these migration campsites, they show evidence that they had boats and that they did offshore fishing. And that's just as we would expect. So, you know, they didn't all have to walk. They had some transportation. Are there similar accounts of what happened at creation, the fall, the flood, and Babel preserved in oral or written form in cultures around the world? Yeah, there are. I'm going to just share a few. There's a lot more in your handout that you can share with your kids. This is just the scripture. God tells them, through Paul in Acts, tells the Greeks, he has not left himself without testimony. And I think part of this is his testimony, just the remembrance of what happened in the past that the people took with them. Popular thought says the nations of the world only became aware of the God of Genesis when Jews or Christians evangelized them. However, there is possibility that pagan man was indeed aware of God long before that and carried it with him to all the nations that he went to. There are over 300 flood legends that go around the world. They predate any contact with outsiders, especially missionaries. They're found in every culture around the world. 30 of them are in writing. I've given you a bunch of them on your handout. 66% say that the flood was caused by the sinfulness of man. 95% say that the world was covered by water. And 86% say that there was a favored family told to build a boat. And that's just as expected. Just one example, the Irish Chronicles, they consider creation and the flood to be recent and historical. In fact, they dated their historical events by counting the years since creation. And according to their record, creation was around 4,000 BC when you kind of put it all together. And the early Britons believed in a recent creation and flood as well. From Denmark, you have the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. They also considered, you know, how long it had been since creation, and they dated their history, how many years it had been since creation. The epic poem Beowulf, did anybody study that in English literature? Yes, we all did. It contains many references to Genesis 1 through 6, including Cain, giants, and a flood, with an abrupt cutoff at that point. And the Saxons, who were Japheth's great-grandkids, brought that to England from Denmark. And Beowulf himself was an historical person who descended from Saxon kings who claimed their ancestry through Japheth. And they have all the names listed between Japheth and Beowulf. From China, you have the Chinese pictographs. There's samples of them that show that when they put these words together, they were referring to something that really fits into the Genesis picture. To forbid, to sacrifice, righteousness, lamb plus me with the lamb placed over the me. The boat, there's the boat right there. Boat is put together by vessel plus eight plus person. It doesn't make sense apart from the Genesis record. And these ancient symbols existed on bronzes and very, very old things already before 800 BC, before any contact with Jews or Christians. These were also disseminated to other Oriental countries before then, too. So these are very ancient symbols. Why are there different races? I'm going to skip this because it's on your handout and you covered some of it today. Where do so-called primitive humans and Stone Age culture fit in the Bible? Well, the question is, what is primitive? People ask me about this. Well, what about Neanderthals? What about Cro-Magnons? And those are the usual candidates for, you know, primitive people. Bones of a man with massive features, heavy brow ridges, rickets, and arthritis were found in Germany, called him Neanderthal. He's sketched as a stooped-over brute, considered a caveman. Bones of a more normal-looking individual were found in France in the Cro-Magnon Valley there. Over 200 skeletons have been found all over from Palestine and Iraq through northwest Africa and throughout Europe. The ones that are found in the more northerly, westerly part of Europe have more Neanderthal-like features, by the way, than the other ones do. The facts. What are the facts about these people? These people walked upright. They were about 5'7" on average, used tools, built houses, contained fires and hearths, wore body ornaments, constructed and played musical instruments, and painted on cave walls, had religious rites, and ceremonially buried their dead. How primitive is that? They had a simple culture, but they didn't have an animal culture. All these things, building houses, you know, making musical instruments. What about the Neanderthal features? You always see the, you know, the brow ridges that stick out here, the sloping forehead, you know, the big skull. They also had a receding chin, and their teeth kind of stuck forward. These are all features of very old people, and most of the skeletons that have been found were buried, and they're of old men. So these are features of old people. So are the thick and large skulls. You know, they had brain, their skulls were bigger than what our modern skulls are, and someone has studied that humans who live 200 to 300 years, if you extrapolate their skulls through computer studies, you'll find out that they look very much like the Neanderthal skulls. So they were probably just very old people. And the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons have a lot of features alike. It looks like they intermarried. And like I said before, the ones that were more northerly had the stronger features. Who were they? Well, both must have been Japheth's descendants, some of them who came from the Tower of Babel. The ones who went further north were those from Gomer. The ones that went further west were those from Javan. It's a good chance that some of the problems that they experienced were due to the ice age and the climate. If you stay inside and you don't get any sun, you don't eat a good diet, you have rough climate, and you live a long time, you're going to have rickets and you're going to have arthritis. And that was one of the problems with those who lived up in the northern part of Europe. Both groups were fully human. The heavy brow ridges and sloping forehead found in Neanderthal skeletons are found in people living today. And Neanderthals would probably go unnoticed if dressed in modern clothing, especially football gear. Where the dinosaurs fit into history and what really happened to them. Our culture's fascination with dinosaurs serves two things: to promote evolution and to indelibly inscribe on the mind of each person that the earth is very old, evolution is a fact, and no man has ever seen a dinosaur. The facts really are on the side of the creationist interpretation, though, and what do you want to know? I've asked several questions and tried to answer them. Did dinosaurs and people live together? Did they go on the ark? We've discussed this before. Yes, they did live together. Dinosaurs went on the ark. Dinosaurs came off the ark. What happened to them afterwards? Two words, they died. Lots of animals have died off the earth. Are they mentioned in the Bible? Well, interestingly, up until this century, there were 20 places in the Old Testament where a particular Hebrew word, tannin, was translated as dragon. It is a word that means monster and dragon. But in this century, modern translators choose not to use that. Why? Because we've never seen one, right? But the descriptions in there are a lot of various sizes and dwelling places. The descriptions can definitely be applied to what we would call dinosaurs in many of the places. Of course, the word dinosaur did not even exist until 150 years ago, a little bit more than that, almost 200 years ago. Before then, anything that was called this was called a monster or a dragon. So if they did know dinosaurs, they wouldn't have called them a dinosaur. And I've given you some more information about that on your handout. Now, God tells us about a couple of them in particular in the Bible. The first one is called Leviathan, and it's the word translated water monster. God describes it as a living, fearsome, fire-breathing monster who lived in the water and on land, had huge teeth, whose scaly hide could not be pierced with sword or spear, was absolutely without fear, and could not be trapped or domesticated. Neither whales, sharks, nor crocodiles fit this description, but it does fit the description of a marine reptile called a Kronosaurus, and that's a faded picture of one there. God says that they were initially created to frolic in the sea, but the description given doesn't look like frolicking. The behemoth is beast par excellence, and it's a huge, large grass eater, had a tail so large it was compared to a cedar tree, had great muscles and extremely strong bones, was not afraid of anything, and is chief in the ways of God, impossible to capture. Now, neither a hippopotamus nor an elephant, which may be in your notes, that that's probably what it was, fit that description. Neither one of them have a tail the size of a cedar tree. But a large sauropod, like Apatosaurus, a Diplodocus, that does. In fact, Diplodocus said its leg bones were so strong that he could have held three others on his back. Other cultures, by the way, did mention Leviathan and Behemoth. So how long do they live after the flood? Well, evidently the dinosaurs gradually died out or they were hunted to extinction. Their existence has been preserved for us, though, by people all over the world in their recorded encounters with what they call dragons. And I'm just going to give you some examples of dragon legends. Now, dragon legends may be embellished memories of real human encounters with dinosaurs. They combined certain features later on, maybe after they were all died out. But we do have some written records that have specific descriptions of animals that we can say that sounds just like a dinosaur. In the 10th century, an Irishman wrote of his encounter with a large beast with iron nails on its tail that pointed backwards and a head shaped like a horse. Well, there's been only one creature that had that, and that was a stegosaurus. A Scandinavian legend describes a reptile-like animal that had a body the size of a large cow covered with scales, two long, strong back legs, two very short front legs with very large jaws, and could leap like a frog. And this is a very close resemblance to a T-Rex, and it's thought that they could leap. In fact, I think they did in Jurassic Park. The city of Nerluc, France, was renamed in honor of a sleigh dragon that was bigger than an ox and had long, sharp, pointed horns on its head. And the further description makes it sound like a triceratop. There's dragon art that's found carved into some ancient canyons. This one on the right, that's from the Grand Canyon. It looks very much like a dinosaur called an Edmontosaurus. And the one on the bottom looks very much like an Apatosaurus, a sauropod. Of course, the Chinese had lots of dragon legends, too. Pterosaurs, very reputable writers, wrote about flying reptiles. Herodotus, Aristotle, Strabo wrote about all these flying reptiles in these particular countries, Egypt, Ethiopia, India, and Arabia. And they knew the difference between a reptile and a bird. They knew that it was not a bird that was flying. They knew it was something different. In 1856, France, a flying reptile was blasted out of a tunnel and then died. It was studied by a scientist. The scientist declared it to be a pterosaur with a 10-foot wingspan. The Celtic and Saxon have several accounts in the British Isles. 80 places have recorded encounters with women, men, and children, with creatures that they may have called monsters, we would call dinosaurs. Multiple witnesses to these accounts, so if anybody was telling us a lie, others could definitely say, well, that's not true, I was there. And they had accounts of creatures spitting poisonous venom at their victims. I thought they was made up in Jurassic Park, but it may have been true. One was vast in body with a crested head, teeth like a saw, and a tail extending to enormous length. It killed the sheep. It liked to eat sheep and shepherds. Local archers tried to kill the beast, but it had an impenetrable hide. Sounds like the one God described in Job. And in Wales, flying reptiles were common until recently. In fact, the country folk predicted the weather by them. Now, these were not birds. They knew they were not birds. They were flying reptiles, and they would predict the weather by them. Also in Wales, there's a carving of a lake-dwelling creature, and this goes back hundreds and hundreds of years before dinosaurs were ever such a popular thing, and it looks just like a marine reptile called a plesiosaur. Beowulf. Once again, Beowulf is a wonderful study on what was actually present at the time when it was originally written. They describe three different monster types in Beowulf: a flying reptile, a sea dragon, which was a harbor menace. They had lots of them in the harbor. And the Viking ships put the heads and the tails. That was based upon this sea dragon. It looks just like a plesiosaur, marine dinosaur. And a land monster called a Grendel. Now, the Grendel was not the proper name of the land monster. It was the type of monster it was. Now, interestingly, it was larger than humans, bipedal, that means walked on 2 feet, with small, puny forelimbs, growled angrily, slayed with his mouth or jaws, swallowing the body of its victims rapidly in large gobbles. Does that sound familiar? It was a nocturnal, solitary hunter approaching human settlements and waiting silently in the darkness for his prey to fall asleep. And the Danes employed a man called a giant watcher who stood guard at night outside the gates of their city to watch for Grendels. And there's a large carved stone in an old Saxon church in England that shows such a creature biting the necks of four-footed creatures. I mean, and it looks just like a T-Rex. But there's too many incidents for us to say that they're all fairy tales. God himself describes a leviathan as shooting forth sparks of fire and smoke going out of its nostrils. Now, is that far-fetched? Well, not really when you examine the bombardier beetle. And this little creature shoots out from its little tail a vapor made from two chemicals stored in its body. It has been, with a camera, shown to be audible pops and puffs of smoke when the beetle sprays. Now, some of the dinosaurs that we find actually have two chambers in their heads, especially crested dinosaurs or duck-billed dinosaurs. And scientists say, well, that was for making mating calls. Well, making sounds, making chemicals. I don't know. It could be. There's just a possibility for it. God says there was a creature that spit out smoke. There probably was. What happened to them? They died. Dinosaurs choking to death from the dust of a meteor impact does not explain why flowering plants or birds survived the Holocaust. And they were probably wiped out by hunters. In the Danish records, it says that these sea dragons were constantly being hunted because they were a menace in the harbors. In Welsh, they were constantly killing these flying reptiles because they were getting their chickens. So they put out hunting parties to go and kill these creatures. If they had been zoos, maybe we could have had some preserved. I wish we could have. It would have just been fun to have a few. There are some may still be hanging around. You know, you hear these reports. They may be around. We don't know. Will they be cloned? Not likely. The bottom line to all of this is that it's important to defend the book of Genesis to ourselves and our children. And we basically finished Genesis today. Next week we start with the rest of the Bible and showing how God goes through history and brings it about at the very end in Revelation before we finish our study this semester. After all, if the first book in the Bible can't be trusted in our eyes or in their eyes, why should any other? And as one woman once asked, when my church told me that I had to accept evolution and that Genesis couldn't be believed as written, I must then ask, when does God start telling the truth? That is a legitimate question. When does God start telling the truth if we don't consider the first 11 chapters of Genesis to be truth? And our kids have the same dilemma. No wonder they find Bible study boring and irrelevant. You know, they're finding out from school and medias and stuff that it's a bunch of bunk. It's just myths. So why study the rest of it? Evaluate everything you read in light of the biblical model. Ask questions. What is the author trying to prove? What is the bias? What is the historian trying to do? Evaluate it. Try to figure out what they're coming from. Look for just the facts. You can read all these articles and glean the facts from them. And it is reasonable to consider that the earth was formed in 6 days, that it was affected by the curse and death after creation, then completely reshaped by a global flood and repopulated by Noah's descendants, all less than 10,000 years ago.